Hello, this is Carol Bond, returning with the July 14th issue of the Decatur Herald and Review. We'll continue now with an article from the editorial page. This is a Decatur Herald and Review staff editorial, and the headline is Politicians Should Listen to Edgar. Politics in Illinois have never been nice. It is a place where rough and tumble attitudes prevail, and there is no room for timidity or thin skins. That attitude, which has accelerated dramatically over the past decade, is precisely why the state is in the shape it's in. The budget deficit is staggering. The governor, when not taking shots at the Democratic leadership at a news conference, is spending money on ads to deliver additional shots. The Democrats, in turn, aim their invective at the governor, portraying him as the modern Ebenezer Scrooge who hates the middle class and wants to give every advantage to big business to deepen the profit margins. While we understand we live in Illinois, this is not exactly following the spirit of Iowa Nice. Someone who does seem to understand the concept of Iowa Nice is former Governor Jim Edgar, arguably the politest Illinois politician in recent memory. Edgar had an easygoing style that appealed to a wide spectrum. There is no stark memory of Edgar flying off the handle in public or raking his opponents over the proverbial coals. Edgar is remembered for his steady hand and calm influence. With that tucked into his resume, Illinois's current political leadership would do well to listen to what Edgar, who served two terms as governor in the 1990s, had to say about the current state of incivility in state politics. Speaking recently on radio station WBBM in Chicago, Edgar said he has an idea for how lawmakers can get past the current budget impasse. They need to start playing nice. In particular, he said, the back and forth between Republican Governor Bruce Rauner and Speaker Mike Madigan, Democrat of Chicago, has to stop. Edgar told a story to illustrate his point. My staff will tell you that there were many times when I was governor, and particularly that first few months, I had a lot of thoughts about Mike Madigan, but I never said them publicly. I worked that out, and we got to be very good friends, actually. In the final weeks of the session in those days, Edgar said, everyone kept their opinions to themselves and got to work. I hope that some private talks will resume. Edgar said Rauner has to realize he's not in the private sector anymore. Democrats, in turn, must realize they can't do things the way they've always done them, calling it a new day in Springfield. There have always been wide disagreements in Illinois politics, but until about the time Rod Blagojevich took the control of the executive office, most everyone was able to make things work. But since then, it has been a continual war of words, with each side trying to use bully tactics to get their way. Illinois has deep problems, and it will take the efforts of both sides to get the state back on the right track. Both the governor and the Democratic leaders in the General Assembly would do well to heed Jim Edgar's advice. Let's read another article from the opinions page. This is also an editorial, but not one written by the Decatur Herald staff. This was written by Kathleen Parker at the Washington Post. And the headline is, A New Day is Dawning in South Carolina. The past may not be past, as William Faulkner once put it, but it sure seems to be leaving. As I watched the broadcast of the Confederate battle flag being brought down from its post on the South Carolina State House grounds Friday morning, my thoughts went to General Robert E. Lee, who surely would have raised a toast to this new day. Yes, you read correctly. The renowned general who surrendered the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia in 1865 was no fan of the flag after the war. Not only did he encourage his fellow Confederates to furl their flags, he didn't want any displayed at his funeral. None was. Lee also opposed the building of memorials to Confederate soldiers, fearing they would stir more division and resentment. Thus, we can infer that he would have been disappointed by the flag's resurrection in South Carolina and elsewhere. He was prescient in imagining the sort of divisiveness we've witnessed as relentless rebels stage heritage claims and others wave the banner as a symbol of racial hostility, if not hate. Friday's ceremony in Columbia was brief, dignified, and profoundly moving for the many gathered, as well as those watching from afar. Governor Nikki Haley, surrounded by fellow officials and lawmakers, looked resplendent in a white suit that was reminiscent of a white flag offered in surrender and in peace. I don't mean the South's surrender to the North or the Sons of Confederate Veterans to the NCAAP, which has fought for the lowering of the flag in South Carolina for more than 20 years. It was the surrender of injured pride to the cause of the greater good. It was the sublimation of I for the liberation of we. South Carolina's better angels were tapped by the departing souls of 9 people gunned down while praying in the historic Mother Emanuel Church, not far from where the first shot of the Civil War was fired. Only silence can capture the totality of so much suffering, forgiveness, surrender, reconciliation, and grace. Adding to the layers of symbolism, it was Haley, an Indian American and the first female governor of the state, who called for the flag to come down. Although she once supported the flag as a part of history, Haley recognized the urgency of its removal, as so many others finally did. It may have been overdue, as critics who never take a vacation will say, but it is done. To non-South Carolinians, this may seem much ado about something that never should have been, as in, what took you so long? Or, why was the Confederate flag raised there in the first place? This is a rhetorical question because we know that it was put there in 1961 to protest the unraveling of Jim Crow. Though officially flown to commemorate the Civil War centennial, the flag was never lowered. Ever since, it was an insistent, ripping reminder to all who passed that South Carolina officially preferred the Old South, which did, in fact, include human bondage. As such, it was a symbolic codification of an attitude that can only be called racist. Its final insult was to wave above the casket bearing State Senator Clementa Pinckney as his body was carried to the Capitol building one last time. Effective Friday, the "Hell no, we ain't forgettin'" crowd no longer controls the message. Whether this symbolic gesture will have a lasting effect remains to be seen, but I predict it will. In the meantime, may the Emanuel 9 rest in peace, and long may the American flag wave. Once again, this was an editorial written by Kathleen Parker of the Washington Post. We turn now to a blog post written by Tim Kaine, H&R Entertainment editor. And his headline is Bloom County Returns. For the first time in 25 years, there's a new Bloom County strip. It may have been a large club, but being a fan of Bloom County in the 1980s made me feel as though I was a member of a really cool private club. Writer Berkeley Breathed seemed to have no desire to be an intellectual language match to Gary Trudeau and his Doonesbury. Breathed regularly proved his wit was just as sharp and he could write successfully at any level. My favorite strip came early in its run, February 1983. When I started as a reporter, I was put in that difficult position of sometimes having to be the first person to give someone terrible news. I always felt and continue to feel uncomfortable doing it, but it's part of the job. That strip showed me I could always be handling it more poorly. The Associated Press story about Bloom County coming back says Breathed has not made clear whether he'll continue the strip or not, but why would he do what he's doing for just one day? One of his Facebook posts discusses how he had to negotiate the look of a character with a newspaper publisher and indicates the conversation led to his decision to stop the strip a few weeks later. And maybe the medium has finally caught up to Berkeley Breathed. There are things on the web that make his most reactionary stuff seem tame. Maybe Breathed can raise the intelligence level of some of the discussions. Or is that too much to ask? This from Tim Kaine. Here's a piece written by Mary Liz Wright, who is a nutrition and wellness educator with the University of Illinois Extension based in Marshall. Her headline is Fair Warning: Annual Trip Can Wreak Havoc on Your Diet. And her column is called To Your Health. Corn dogs and cotton candy. What trip to the fair would be complete without them? Ask anyone what they enjoy most about the fair, and they may well say, the food. The once-a-year treat can pack some big calories into your regular diet, so here are a few tips. Most of us know that the donut burger is probably a bad choice. 1,500 calories. However, we might be surprised by the better choices. Are you a sweet tooth person? Or is it the salty snacks that you crave? Either way, be prepared to amp up your exercise routine to pay for fair food. So just what are we talking about? What's a few fair treats going to hurt? Well, for example, the fried onion blossom will set you back 1,320 calories. You can have one and then walk around the fairgrounds for 4 hours and 25 minutes to burn it off. Are funnel cakes your weakness? A plain one with powdered sugar topping has 760 calories. A measly 2 hours and 50 minutes will take care of its calories. At this rate, the 620 calorie curly fries seem almost like health food. Pizza on a stick, fried butter, chocolate covered bacon, the list is endless. What is a better choice at the fair? Remember, anything you eat at the fair is classified as a sometimes food rather than an everyday food. So you know that you will consume some extra calories and fat. That being said, you might opt for cotton candy at 171 calories or a chocolate-covered banana with the benefit of a serving of fruit and 240 calories. Actually, in the deep-fried category, corn dogs weigh in at 250 calories. That's much better than a donut burger. Am I saying that you shouldn't eat at the fair? Absolutely not. The fair comes once a year. Treat yourself to your favorite. Just remember to plan the days around your fair trip accordingly. Increase your fruits and veggies along with exercise. When you go to the fair, walk around the grounds, visit the livestock, and then the memory of your trip to the fair will not be a bigger pant size, rather a mental picture of a time well spent. Let's listen now to some articles or some writing from the Decatur Tribune online. And the front page actually has letters to the editor. The first is headlined, Councilman to ask City Council to consider raising the minimum wage to $10 per hour. The letter reads like this, Dear Editor, I plan to ask the City Council to consider raising the minimum wage of Decatur workers to $10 per hour. The Founding Fathers understood that the new republic would not survive unless the people exhibited civic virtue, placing the welfare of the community ahead of self-interest and private profits. Democracy is a rare event in human history. Democracy has no recipe or ideal form. Democracy is what the society wishes it to be. But to endure, democracy must be tended daily like a garden. Our country seems to be moving faster than ever on the outside, but inside we are weakening. A historic tension exists between private profits and democratic or community values. Community requires equality, justice, participation, and cooperation. When the minimum wage increase is proposed, we will see how the tension plays out between private profits and the need of our community and the thousands of low-paid workers who make Decatur their home. May God bless America, stand by her side, and guide her. And the signature is Bill Faber, Decatur. The next letter to the editor is headlined, Same-sex marriage right nonsense. Dear editor, the recent same-sex marriage opinion issued by the Supreme Court is a travesty of justice. Power over marriage belongs to the states. Only the states have the authority to define marriage. The Supreme Court doesn't. No person in any of the 50 states was denied marriage. All persons of legal age could choose an opposite-sex person to marry. The five majority justices relied heavily on the 14th Amendment to bolster their argument. Problem is, in 1868, when the 14th Amendment was ratified, homosexual contact was a crime in every state in America. So, suggesting that the meaning and intent of the 14th Amendment was to grant a same-sex marriage right is laughable. It's simply ridiculous, because doing so would have immediately made anyone openly homosexual a criminal and subject to arrest. It's obvious the five majority justices on the Supreme Court just made up a right. They pulled it out of thin air. Those five unelected justices wrote law by redefining marriage. They should be impeached for their immoral judicial tyranny. Rule of law matters, and they need to be held accountable for unlawfully forcing their will onto the country. and the signature is Roger German Decatur. The next letter to the editor, also on the front page, is headlined, Decatur's Pathway to Prosperity. Dear editor, for positive transformation to take place, a city needs a strategic plan and dedicated stakeholders working together to achieve success. Decatur is fortunate to be anchored by initiatives, businesses, organizations, and citizens that are fostering collaborations and partnerships that will enable our city to prosper. Grow Decatur is an initiative led by volunteers that is helping to shape a shared vision for our city. Over the past several weeks, leaders of Grow Decatur have facilitated several workshops on critical community imperatives, including poverty, education, housing, and workforce and economic development. Through its inclusive approach, the volunteers of Grow Decatur are helping to bring together the people who will ultimately develop and implement solutions to our city's challenges. Fulfilling a shared vision requires capitalizing on our strengths. One of Decatur's many strengths is its citizens and the neighborhoods in which we live. Many entities in our city have strong community service programming, and our neighborhood groups under the Coalition of Neighborhood Organizations can provide significant grassroots support that will help our city and its citizens prosper in fulfilling our shared vision. The cooperative spirit and strong capabilities of our citizens are Decatur's greatest assets. When we combine initiatives such as Grow Decatur and City Limitless with strong neighborhoods and affiliated organizations, Decatur's pathway to increased prosperity is assured. Signed, David Horn, Decatur. The next letter has as its title, Only Half of the Story. Dear Editor, many Macon County residents recently received postal correspondence from E. on the homegrown clean energy people. They're touting the benefits of renewable wind energy in support of our local farmers and other Macon County taxing bodies. The data they present is compelling, even when it's not projected over 30 years. However, as with many green energy cost projections, they only relate half of the story, i.e., the good half. In a real world with a free market, not a single dime would ever be invested in clean energy because without the 35% federal subsidy, the return on investment is simply not there. A billion-dollar project only costs the investors $650 million since the rest is taxpayers' dollars. Never listed as a line item expense on the federal budget. So once again, those of us who do pay taxes are footing the bill. But here's the real kicker. The out-of-pocket cost to the individual or commercial electrical consumer will ultimately skyrocket since the subsidized cost of wind energy production is 92 times higher than natural gas production costs. All this data was well documented by a recent Decatur Club speaker, Ms. Denine Borelli, in her book, Backlash. Government-provided data reveals that wind energy costs $23 per megawatt hour. Natural gas energy production cost is 25 cents per megawatt hour. See for yourself in the subsidy link at www.eia.gov/energy. So under the current regulations, the next time someone is touting green energy, ask them if they are prepared to have a potential 92 times increase in their power bill. And that letter was signed Robert Kimmons of Warrensburg. The very next letter is called World Wants to Change Beautiful Union That God Has Created. Dear editor, I totally agree that we all have rights that should be respected and be treated equally. The gay community do love each other and show their love in a very special way and deserve to be respected, but this is not marriage. Marriage is the bonding of the male and female in total commitment and physically bonding to make them one, to bring new life into the world. This is never possible in the gay community. Unfortunately, the world wants to change the beautiful union that God has created. It saddens me that the Supreme Court has gone the way of some who want it changed, something I will never be able to live with. Signed, Mary Lou Meyer of Decatur. At the conclusion of these letters, there is a statement, above letters were posted on June 30th, 2015. Osborne Online headline, Dress Code Has Undergone Major Alterations Over the Years. Recently on our Facebook page, I posted some photos of Decatur High School girls carrying their books in the downtown of the 1940s. I was actually posting the photos to show some of the downtown businesses that existed back then that could be seen in the background. Then I noticed in every photo of the high school girls, all of them were wearing dresses. There were no slacks, jeans, or any other form of attire in the photos because they were not allowed. Quite a few readers of the item indicated that when they attended school or when their mothers did, they were not permitted to wear anything but dresses, even on the coldest days. Buffy Gentry wrote, I remember my mother telling me she was chastised for wearing jeans under her dress to grade school when it was very cold in the 1960s. Karen Sue Hunter Banks wrote, I remember in grade school we were forbidden to wear anything but a dress. Karen Court wrote that the dress code was not only imposed in Decatur but in other Central Illinois communities. Karen wrote that the dress code was not she wrote that, quote, I was in third grade or fourth grade before the school dress code allowed girls to wear slacks of any kind. My sister got sent home from Arthur High School when it was bitter cold for wearing a nice pantsuit that my mom made. So dresses were still the norm up to the early 70s. Gay Pritchard Bunch wrote, the school dress code changed in 1970-71, I think. I was in eighth grade, and we were finally allowed to wear jeans and slacks. Lois Nethery wrote, I graduated from Eisenhower in 1959, and I remember we had to wear skirts or dresses, and I remember wearing hose. You could wear bobby socks, penny loafers, or white bucks, which was the rage. You also had to have skirts that came below the knee until mini skirts came in. I graduated from high school in 59, and in thinking back, all the women teachers I had, not one of them ever wore jeans or anything else but dresses. But it wasn't only teachers and girls. That's the way the vast majority of women dress when they were working in an office, a retail business, or shopping downtown. Times have changed, and many in the general population wear about anything they want and don't care what anyone thinks about it. Still, when I think back of the big dress code of another era, apparently it only applied to girls. Remember those basketball uniforms that high school players wore? The shorts were so short that old game film is embarrassing to watch today. Yet I don't think any of us thought anything about it. I wonder what future generations will think of what we wear today when they look at old photos of 2015. This has been Carol Bond reading with you today from the July 15th issue of the Decatur Herald and Review, and also from the Decatur Tribune Online. I look forward to reading with you again.